This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 161, Meet the Neighbors Speed Round. Fun fact for everybody who's been listening over the last 7 years of this podcast, which is truly an insane milestone to be reaching. The intro phrase that I use in every episode is something that my dog has interpreted as a direction to go lay in her bed. In the last two episodes, we covered some of the history of Greek philosophy and medicine, especially as they related to the Seleucid Empire, to the limited extent that our sources say anything at all. This time, we are winding back up to the historical narrative with a rapid-fire version of Meet the Neighbors to get caught up on the internal affairs of the Seleucids' three most powerful and long-lasting borders, the Ptolemies, the Antigonids, and the Mauryans. Too much has happened in all three kingdoms to do any of them justice in just one episode, but quite frankly, I don't want to get too bogged down in their histories, as two-thirds of them are on the verge of collapse by the time we get to the 2nd century BC anyway. But that is getting ahead of myself. The narrative will resume in 223 BCE, so that is our goal for today. Let's start with Egypt, because that's definitely the one that requires the least explanation, due in no small part to the fact that the Ptolemies are usually the Seleucids' prime antagonist, and the fact that we've basically seen the first half of Ptolemy III Euergetes' reign in our regular narrative episodes. Ptolemy III came to power, married Berenike of Cyrenaica, sponsored some anti-Antigonid rebels in Greece, and mostly turned around to assist his sister in Syria. Berenike of Syria was assassinated, and Ptolemy all but conquered northern Syria and Mesopotamia for a few years before drought, famine, and rebellion forced him to return home while Seleucus II went on the offensive in the Third Syrian War. Ironically, we know very little about that rebellion or rebellions. They were a native Egyptian revolt against Ptolemaic rule, but so far as we know, there wasn't any claim to the old pre-Persian dynasties like we saw frequently in the rebellions against the Achaemenids. That said, even if the uprising was largely populist, spurred by the heavy tax burden and impact of famine on the lower and middle classes within Egypt, there's a chance that they were egged on, supported, or partly co-opted by elements in northern Nubia. We haven't heard much from Nubia, also called the Kingdom of Kush in modern Sudan, aside from a brief war of annexation by Ptolemy II. But we know two things. One of the final pharaohs to resist Persia, Naktorheb II, ultimately fled into exile in northern Nubia. And a later rebel in the Ptolemaic period that did proclaim himself pharaoh was supposedly from Nubia. Regardless, once local affairs were mostly settled in Egypt, Ptolemy Euergetes spent his time and effort funding the enemies of his enemies, notably paying for some of Antiochus Hyrax's Galatian mercenaries and Attalus of Pergamon's conquest of Anatolia. Euergetes was also a major backer of the Achaean and Aetolian leagues in Greece, but we'll get to that a bit later. Domestically, Ptolemy III continued his father's efforts to expand Egyptian trade in the Indian Ocean, both by supporting the outposts far to the south and establishing trade relations with tribes and states at least as far south as Jubaland, in modern Somalia, and potentially as far as modern Tanzania. It's not clear whether or not the Ptolemies were yet traveling that far themselves, or more accurately, sending their Egyptian subordinates that far, but we do know that southern African ports, like the Emporium the Greeks called Rapta, were integrated into trade linking the Mediterranean with far-off lands like modern Indonesia as early as the 5th century BC through a variety of intermediaries. Like his forefathers, Euergetes continued to work on integrating his own family directly into the Egyptian religion, notably deifying a daughter called Berenike, who died in infancy. However, he more notably shifted the royal family's priorities in the native Egyptian gods. Since Alexander the Great had first arrived, the Macedonian rulers of Egypt aligned themselves with the god Amun, who they associated with the Greek Zeus. Euergetes put his emphasis on Ptah, an important god whose living avatar was the famed Apis bull. He was most often associated with the Greek god Hephaestus rather than Zeus, but also Ptolemy III's other favorite god, Serapis. Serapis is a weird case for another day, I think, but basically, while he may have had some pre-Hellenistic roots in Egypt, his cult emerged as an important influence under the Ptolemies, and he became a decidedly Greco-Egyptian concept, almost purely a Hellenistic invention pushed by the Ptolemies as a fusion of the Egyptian god-king Osiris and Apis, aka the living herald of Ptah. So Serapis was a natural fit for a Ptolemaic rebrand. Ptolemy Euergetes built several temples to Serapis, most importantly including the Serapeum district of Alexandria, which included an expansion to the capital city's famed library. Speaking of the library, I just find this a little hilarious. Ptolemy III borrowed the official manuscripts of the great playwrights from the library at Athens, When you borrowed scrolls from these ancient libraries, you paid an individual deposit for each work. Like a modern rental deposit, you would return the scrolls and get your money back. The more unique the work, the more expensive that deposit was going to be. Official manuscripts like these were carefully preserved and copied by the best scribes in Athens to ensure accuracy in transmission. These were the official copies of the original text written by the great writers of antiquity. Ptolemy simply treated the deposit for these manuscripts as a great bargain and refused to send them back, transferring the official copy of the original text of many famous plays to the Library of Alexandria. Working from that library, it was also under Ptolemy III's patronage that the mathematician Eratosthenes became the first Greek to accurately estimate the circumference of the earth. And for anybody wondering, this is where the reputation of the Library of Alexandria as an almost mythical store of knowledge comes from. It's not so much that it had a ton of unique works that were lost whenever the library was periodically burned to the ground. It's that they hoarded the original official texts, meaning that after the library was first destroyed, many of those official copies were lost to the ages, and there was no longer an official copy for other scribes to work off of. Now we shift our attention north to Macedon, where we last checked in with Antigonus Gonatas' death in 239 BCE. The throne passed to his son Demetrius, who was immediately faced by the consequences of his father's effort to dominate the rest of Greece. Three leagues of city-states rallied against him: the Aetolian League, near Macedon's southern border, and the north side of the Gulf of Corinth, centered on a city called Thamon; the Boeotian League, north of Attica and centered on Thebes, we're familiar with them; and the Achaean League in the Peloponnese, centered at this time on a city called Aegion. At this point in the Hellenistic Age, the Achaean League had mostly replaced the old Spartan Peloponnesian League, but served a similar function. That said, Boeotia was a pale shadow of its once great power a century earlier. The Aetolians and Achaeans were the big players in southern Greece by the late 3rd century. This coalition rose against Demetrius II almost immediately after he came to power, and Demetrius, to his credit, rose to meet them. In 236 BC, he marched through northern Greece, choosing to absorb much of the northeastern peninsula directly into the kingdom of Macedon, rather than leaving local city-states to function as vassals and clients. When the Macedonian army hit Boeotia, the Boeotian League submitted almost immediately without a fight. During his father's reign, Demetrius had officially commanded the Macedonian army sent to defeat Alexander II of Epirus and occupy that country on Macedon's western border. By the time Demetrius became king, the full occupation of Epirus had ended, but the successors of Alexander II were effectively subjects of Macedon regardless, and ineffective ones at that. Pyrrhus II died without a male heir, passing the throne to his brother Ptolemy, who died while campaigning against the Illyrian kingdom to his north. Ptolemy's son Pyrrhus reigned for just a few months before being assassinated by a cousin, Didamia. As the last member of the Epirote royal family still in the country, Didamia ruled directly as a queen, but proved disastrously unpopular, stemming from the whole assassinating a more popular predecessor thing. Epirus rose in revolution, and Deidamia was killed while trying to sue for peace around 233. The victorious rebels transitioned Epirus into an oligarchic republic in the same style as Rome, or whatever on and off again republican system Cyrenaica was using. Technically, through one of his wives, Demetrius II had a claim on the Epirote throne, or could press for his son, Philip, to be acknowledged as king, but by then, there was blood in the water. The Aetolian League invaded Epirus and seized the former Epirote capital at Ambracia, attempting to conquer the whole territory and keep it out of Macedonian hands. Demetrius allied himself with King Agron of Illyria, and the Illyrians assaulted the Aetolians, driving them out of the region altogether. According to the later historian Polybius, Agron celebrated his victory with so much revelry that he died, either of pleuritis or a heart attack. His wife, Teuta, took over as queen regent and continued pressing for expansion to the south, especially to raid islands in the Ionian Sea, which, confusingly, is between Greece and Italy, nowhere near the region we call Ionia. I apologize for this flood of information. I'm just trying to get this section of Illyria and Epirus caught up in the timeline. Demetrius continued to war against the Aetolians, earning the epithet Aetolicus for his near-continuous conflict with the League, until Dardania, an Illyro-Thracian kingdom directly north of Macedon, launched an invasion around 230 BC. Demetrius was killed in this conflict. His son Philip was only 9 years old. So Demetrius's younger brother, a new Antigonus, was named regent. Remembered by history as Antigonus III Doson, the new ruler quickly finished the war and repelled the Dardanians before turning around to put down a succession revolt in Thessaly. Once it was clear that Antigonus Doson was a capable ruler, he was acknowledged as king, but Doson never intended to remove his nephew from the order of succession. The 9-year-old Philip just had to wait his turn while an adult ruled instead. The next bit of Greek history had so many moving parts. In particular, events around the Ionian Sea in this period are building toward climactic events that we quite simply do not have time for in this triple-header episode. So I'll keep it brief. Queen Teuta of Illyria sent raiders to pillage and conquer the island of Corcyra, also known as Corfu. Corcyra called on the allied forces of the Aetolian and Achaean leagues, but they were defeated and Corcyra fell to the Illyrian invaders. For anybody keeping track at home, this battle took place off the coast of the smaller islands nearby and was called the Battle of Paxos. This defeat, or more accurately, disagreements between the allied forces leading up to the battle, began to drive a wedge between the two powerful Greek alliances in 229 BC. Then, events in Sparta upended the whole political situation of the region, as Spartans are historically prone to do. We, of course, haven't heard much from the Spartans since the end of the Cremonidean War and the death of Arius I, one of Sparta's two kings back in 261. Arius's death sparked a struggle for power inside the dual monarchy, with both royal houses trying to get ahead. This all came to a sudden halt when the Agiad dynasty, King Leonidas II, was deposed and replaced by his son, Cleomenes III. Interesting for this podcast, Cleomenes might have been something of a Seleucid himself. Leonidas II was raised at the court of Seleucus Nicator and married either a Seleucid princess or a Persian noblewoman. Our ancient sources are split on that. In the end, it didn't matter much, because Sparta and the Seleucids were effectively cut off from one another at this point by all of the many political influences in between. Leonidas II had just executed his rival in the Eurypontid royal dynasty, a reformist called Agis, who was desperately trying to restore Spartan military capabilities by restarting the Agoge training program for children and redistributing land to increase the number of citizens that could be recruited to the army. At this point in time, there were just 700 legal Spartan citizens. The population of the city hadn't gone down all that much, it's just that that few people still had legal citizenship. Because citizenship was based on land ownership, and as the generations continued, the land was parceled out into smaller and smaller pieces, or bought up into larger and larger pieces, that only a few people could actually qualify for the legal category. The new Cleomenes became the compromise candidate here, in that neither of his predecessors were powerful, successful, or popular, and he saw an opportunity to use some of Agis's land reform and his own family's support from the remaining Spartan citizens to remilitarize the Spartan state. Sparta remained one of the only major cities in the Peloponnese not to join the Achaean League, primarily because the Spartans only wanted an alliance if they were in charge. So as the Greek leagues usually did when they became powerful, the Achaeans tried to force holdouts to join by force and mounted an invasion of Sparta's allies in Arcadia. There were also a few scattered cities in the Peloponnese who paid dues to the Aetolian League on the other side of the Corinthian Gulf for their own political reasons, but with increasing Achaean aggression, those cities sided with Sparta. By mid-229, this escalated into an all-out war. Sparta reinforced border fortresses, which looked like a good enough casus belli to the Achaeans. The Achaeans tried to launch a surprise attack by night on some of the Spartan allies. But their fifth columnists didn't turn up inside the city. A surprise attack looked like a good reason to go to war for Sparta, so it began. Cleomenes was very bullish about going on the offensive, but his assembly of elders, the Spartan ephors, was not, and they held him back while the Achaeans launched a more successful invasion of Arcadia. Only then was Cleomenes allowed to start the war in earnest. Tens of thousands of troops began marching across the Peloponnese, angling for battle, but never quite committing. Seemingly in an effort to speed things up, and to pick the side least likely to side with Macedon, Ptolemy III started sending money to Sparta to hire mercenaries. There is also some evidence to suggest that Cleomenes or his allies assassinated two candidates for the Eurypontid dynasty's throne, allowing the Augead king to remain the sole power in Sparta during the conflict. This war went down in history as the Cleomenian War, both because Cleomenes started it, and because he used the conflict itself as a weapon in Spartan politics. While marching toward Megalopolis, the Spartans captured a village called Leuctra, and routed the Achaean army, killing one of Megalopolis's primary commanders in a cavalry skirmish. This boosted morale in the Spartan host and led to a massive, successful charge against the main Achaean army. From there, Cleomenes led his forces across the Peloponnese, capturing several cities and relieving his allies in the city of Orchomenos from a siege. He used the constant fighting and exhausting marches to his own advantage, placing domestic political opponents in the front lines to kill them off over the course of the war. Those who remained were so exhausted that they were happy to stay with the contingent of the Spartan army left to occupy Arcadia when Cleomenes went home to Sparta. When he got back, the king invaded there as well, invaded his own capital city, killing 4 of the 5 ephors and occupying Sparta with mercenaries, while he forced through a series of land reforms and new citizenship laws that brought the official Spartan citizenship rolls back up to 4,000 from its pre-war state of 700. He also restored the agoge to reignite Spartan militarism and began training his soldiers out of the now highly outdated classical Greek hoplite warfare to fight as a Macedonian-style phalanx. Eventually, Cleomenes installed his own brother, Anargiad, on the Europontid throne, officially preserving the dual monarchy, but effectively rendering himself the lone king of Sparta with no council of ephors to oppose singular monarchic rule. In 226, after some hesitation, Cleomenes sent his mother and children to Egypt as political hostages in exchange for further support from Ptolemy III. Apparently, Ptolemy was now convinced that Sparta was going to become the preeminent power in Greece once again, and felt that he needed to ensure Cleomenes' cooperation in any future war. The Spartans put that funding to good use, launching a campaign into the heart of Achaea, and crushing the Achaean army in the Battle of Dume, capturing several more towns and cities, and giving them over to be ruled by other Spartan allies. At this point, the Achaeans were demoralized, suffering heavy losses, and struggling to find allies. They were turned down by the Aetolians and the Athenians in negotiations, so they sued for peace. But Cleomenes made untenable demands of the Achaean League, eventually demanding that he be placed in charge, effectively saying that he would only accept surrender if he absorbed the Achaean League into his own alliance, which was increasingly starting to look like a single, huge Spartan kingdom. Fortunately for the Achaeans, Cleomenes fell ill and had to postpone the negotiations, which gave them time to find a new ally in the form of Antigonus III of Macedon. Antigonus Doson offered to join the war directly, on the condition that Macedon would reoccupy the Acrocorinth and control the isthmus between Attica and the Peloponnese once again. The Achaeans agreed, and negotiations for peace with Sparta collapsed. The Achaeans began fortifying their remaining strongholds, with the exception of Argos, which was in the middle of a festival called the Nemean Games. Cleomenes took advantage of this, seizing control of the area nearest the Argive Theater, and forcing the city to surrender without a fight, thus becoming the first Spartan king to defeat Argos, the traditional Spartan rival for the preceding 400 or 500 years. From there, he went to Sicyon, accepting a few more surrenders along the way. Then, Antigonus Doson arrived with over 20,000 troops. As he advanced through eastern Greece, Cleomenes pulled back to the Acrocorinth and fortified the entire width of the isthmus with a trench and a wall to hold back the Macedonian advance. This worked for a while. The city of Lycaon, at the northern end of this fortification line, repelled several Antigonid attacks, before Argive rebels arranged for 1,500 Macedonians to come over by sea and overthrow the Spartan occupation. Simultaneously, the Achaean army went on the offensive, marching out of Sicyon. Unable to fight on three fronts at once and at risk of being surrounded, Cleomenes and the Spartans withdrew to the city of Mantinea, abandoning Corinth to the Antigonid army. Cleomenes' wife died around the same time, forcing him to personally return to Sparta for the funeral. Meanwhile, Antigonus met with the Achaean leadership and representatives from most of the prominent Greek leagues and alliances to reinstitute a pan-Hellenic league in the same way as Philip II had a century earlier. This was now the so-called League of Leagues, which included most of Greece and Epirus with the exception of Athens, Sparta, and the Aetolians, aka Athens and Macedon's two main military rivals at the time. Antigonus led his new league, effectively just an expanded kingdom of Macedon, on the offensive in the spring of 223, and they began sweeping through Laconia and the other territories still under Spartan occupation. Antigonus also cut a deal with Ptolemy Euergetes, ceding control of a few cities in Thrace and northern Anatolia that paid tribute to Macedon, in exchange for Ptolemy cutting off the Spartans' war fund. Cleomenes started selling freedom to Helot serfs in Laconia at the bare minimum price he could justify to his people, both raising fresh troops and some additional money, but that was only a temporary fix, and he had to have known it would cause problems later. It was just dire circumstances. In an overnight surprise attack, the Spartans were able to occupy Megalopolis, hoping to ransom the city to its own citizens in exile, if they would come home and support Sparta. The exiles refused, and the Spartans burned the city to the ground, taking whatever loot they could carry. This shocked the Achaeans especially, but it did not have the desired effect on Antigonus and the Macedonians. Rather than becoming a stunning Spartan victory and demoralizing the League of Leagues, it demonstrated the need for a swift end to the war. By summer of 222, Sparta had been pushed back to their home territory in Laconia and very little else. Cleomenes had all of the passes and main points of entry into the country fortified, but almost 30,000 troops under Antigonus bore down on the single pass of Cilicia. The terrain didn't play to either army's strength necessarily. Macedonian phalanxes don't handle hills much better than the traditional Greek model, but that was true on both sides. The Macedonians had better cavalry and mercenary forces like the Illyrians, with more experience in difficult terrain. After lots of positioning and repositioning, an Achaean commander called Philopoemen of Megalopolis forced the two armies to start the battle with a cavalry charge, and eventually the Spartan left flank collapsed. Cleomenes ran home, briefly, urging the Spartan assembly to accept whatever terms Antigonus offered, and then he got on a boat and fled to Egypt. Officially, Antigonus undid all of Cleomenes' reforms and restored the ephors. But in practice, land reform is very difficult to undo, and the dual monarchy never came back. Cleomenes was gone, and his brother was killed at Cilicia. So a cousin named Agesipolis III briefly became the singular king of Sparta before he was deposed by a man called Lycurgus, who at least claimed Eurypontid descent. Regardless, Sparta became just another petty Hellenistic monarchy, and much of its unique form of government fell into history after Cleomenes' defeat. Ptolemy III tacitly welcomed Cleomenes and promised him a pension, but Ptolemy died of natural causes a few months later. Meanwhile, Antigonus Doson went north to fight another Dardanian invasion, only to be killed in battle, or contract some kind of illness that killed him by 221. Egypt passed to Ptolemy IV, remembered as Philopator, the one who loved his father. Macedon went back to Antigonus's nephew, Philip V. Still only 17 years old, but at least sort of capable of ruling in his own name. However, we left the Seleucids back in 223. So now we switch gears entirely and jump clear to the other side of the Seleucid Empire to discuss a different imperial power, Mauryan India. And it has been a long time since we checked in over there. Get ready for spring and summer travel season. If you have travel coming up, spring break, summer vacations, weddings, or international work trips, or maybe you work in an industry that is affected by all of those things, imagine actually understanding the language of the place or people you're working with, ordering confidently, connecting with locals, feeling immersed instead of just visiting a place. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb a new language. There's no memorizing random vocabulary and no relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in their natural context, the way a language is meant to be learned. It's the way you learned your first one. I'll keep harping on this for as long as they let me. I really like their true accent feature. Something that you don't realize until you start getting into the whole breadth of human language is that there's so many sounds that English doesn't use, or that your first language doesn't use. And having a built-in sort of accent coach can really help improve those sounds that you're not familiar with. The immersive method lets you learn faster and retain longer, helping you think and communicate in a new language with confidence. It's an intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and eventually getting you up to full sentences. You can take this on the road or at home, learn anytime, anywhere with a desktop program or a mobile app, and you can do that whether you have 5 minutes or an hour to work on your skills. Ready to start learning a new language this spring? Visit rosettastone.com/today today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. March is the month of International Women's Day, a moment to celebrate women's strength and progress while also recognizing how much they carry with them every day. So this month, BetterHelp is taking a moment to celebrate women and all that they carry, whether that's in their careers, their relationships, their families, and the many other roles in their day-to-day lives. My wife just finished her PhD. It's this monumental accomplishment in her life, and we're excited to move on to next steps. But the process of getting a PhD and the process of entering a highly specialized job market in 2026 is wildly stressful, and therapy has been able to play a huge role in helping with that. She's made progress on many things over the last few years, and it's helping both of us work through the transition into the next month. And that's really what this is all for. Take a second and think about all of the stress of your career, where you are in life, or where you're going. All of that pressure builds up, and therapy can help create a balance, set healthy boundaries, and support overall well-being for everyone. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals instead of scrolling through search results to try and find a therapist. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12 plus years of experience means they typically get a good match the first time. If you aren't happy with that match, switch it up to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com. The last time I talked about the Mauryan Empire was in episode 145, covering the reigns of Bindusara and Ashoka Maurya, particularly in relation to the Seleucid Empire. We left off with Ashoka Maurya, deeply repentant and devoutly Buddhist in the aftermath of the Kalinga War, working hard to atone for the violence committed on his behalf, and proselytizing Buddhism with missionaries sent as far west as Libyan Cyrenaica, and significantly more proselytizing in and around India itself. Ashoka's missionaries went all over the Indian subcontinent, to Sri Lanka, into the Himalayas, eastern Iran, and east into Myanmar and Thailand. These missions were more successful and best remembered in Sri Lanka. But Buddhism did begin to spread out from Ashoka's realm. Of course, that does not mean the violence stopped entirely. Wars of conquest mostly came to an end, largely due to the fact that there was very little left to conquer. The West ran up against the Seleucids, still relatively stable and powerful for the rest of Ashoka's life. The north ran into the Himalayas, which are the Himalayas, and the east and south ran into inhospitable forests. Instead, the violence of Ashoka Maurya's later life turned inward on India itself. With increasing persecution of those deemed heretics against Buddhism and other competing religions, especially the Jains and Ajivikas. The Jains especially were becoming highly influential in Ashoka's time, and his personal style of government became more and more of a Buddhist theocracy. Pogroms were launched against the Jains, with a blanket bounty on the heads of any heretics, up to and including Ashoka's own brother. He died around 232 BCE after falling severely ill for several days. Supposedly, on his deathbed, Ashoka attempted to donate so much money to Buddhist Sangha shrines that his ministers intervened and cut off the king's access to the royal treasury. Even then, according to legend, he gave away all of his personal possessions, leaving his successor only those luxuries owned by the state. By the end of Ashoka's life, the first cracks started to show in the Mauryan Empire. As king, Ashoka was known to have several wives and consorts and many children, but the vast majority of them have gone undocumented in surviving sources. One, of dubious historical reality, was called Jaloka. According to local tradition in Kashmir, Jaloka and Ashoka were both devotees of the god Shiva. This isn't technically incompatible with Buddhism, but nothing else in history backs it up. Regardless, that same tradition held that Jaloka became some sort of semi-independent vassal king of Kashmir during his father's lifetime, and remained in that position after Ashoka's death. Another, Kunala, was considered Ashoka's heir apparent, raised and educated in the city of Wijayan, but blinded by a conspiracy from one of Ashoka's wives trying to promote her own son to displace Kunala. Many ancient societies stigmatized disability, and blindness or facial disfiguration was occasionally used as a punishment specifically to eliminate a prince from the line of succession. So Kunala was not allowed to inherit the throne. By the time Ashoka died, most sources agree that all of his sons had died earlier or been disqualified, either because they held other important offices, became monks and missionaries, or had other factors working against them, like disfiguration. Kunala's own son was too young, so the throne passed to Ashoka's eldest grandson, Dasharatha Maurya. In the Vishnu Purana, Dasharatha's father, called Suyashas, is actually identified as a son of Ashoka who succeeded his father. But if this Suyashas really existed, his reign must have been very short. We don't know much about what was actually happening in India during Dasharatha's reign. This is partially a side effect of the Indian sources' tendency to use different names for the same individual depending on language, religion, and other traditions. So there may be references to Dasharatha that we simply don't realize are about the Mauryan king. Broadly speaking, Mauryan authority fractured in this period, not unlike what was happening in the Seleucid Empire during the same time. One theory holds that the entire realm may have split in a state of cold war between the blinded Kunala and Dasharatha, with some Mauryan subjects not objecting to the former's blindness as much as his own father. The Puranas also reference several Mauryan princes ruling their own territories in this period, apparently acting as viceroys on Dasharatha's behalf, but wielding almost total autonomy. And those are just the ways in which the Mauryan Empire fractured within their normal imperial system. I already mentioned the example of Jaloka, the new king's uncle who set up his own independent territory in Kashmir. Tarnatha, a Buddhist monk and historian in the 16th century CE, wrote using now lost sources and suggested that Gandhara also broke away under a rebel Mauryan prince called Virasena, probably from a different branch of the family than Ashoka and his descendants. Greek sources, as we will see in an upcoming episode, mention another breakaway kingdom in the Hindu Kush, or what is now northern Pakistan, ruled by a king they called Sophagasinus, who may have been another separatist or one of Verasena's heirs. It's kind of hard to tell, mixing and matching Greek and much later Indian records. The region of Vidarbha, in central India, right in the center of the empire, broke away, as did many states in southern India that had submitted to Ashoka and his predecessors as vassals. Several regions along the coast of the subcontinent joined them. Perhaps most embarrassingly yet predictably, Kalinga, the region that Ashoka had conquered with extraordinary violence, reasserted independence during the reign of Dasharatha. Like his grandfather, Dasharatha was a great patron of Buddhism, at least in his official inscriptions and policies, but he was not nearly as zealous as Ashoka. The Jains were allowed to become influential again, with several of the secessionist dynasties committing themselves to Jain beliefs. Dasharatha himself even seems to have been interested and friendly toward the Ajivikas, the fatalistic Sramana movement founded in the religious milieu that created Buddhism and Jainism as well. Dasharatha dedicated several shrines in the Barabar Caves, not far from his capital at Pataliputra, in Ajivika style. Dasharatha died around the same time as Seleucus II Callinicus in 224 BCE, under unknown circumstances, though he seems to have been quite young. The available sources just don't mention a cause of death. He was succeeded by Samprati Maurya, his relative? The Puranas say it's a son, other sources say it's a cousin or a brother. It was another Mauryan descendant of Ashoka. With the loss of territory in Gujarat, Kashmir, and Gandhara, it's hard to imagine that Dasharatha maintained much of a hold on eastern Iran and the Indus Valley either. So we won't be seeing much from Samprati during our return to the narrative. Unlike his predecessors, Samprati moved away from devout Buddhism. And in fact, he became a Jain, and heavily supported Jainist missionaries both within his territory and beyond. He built and maintained many Jain temples and shrines, ensuring safety for missionary travelers. Samprati also set to work reconquering the secessionist regions of the empire, beginning with the span of breakaway states on the western coast, and the Andharas on the eastern coast of India. There is some information from the Yuga Purana to suggest that the Mauryans did reassert authority in the Indus Valley, but never again across the mountains. The Mauryan Empire never managed to expand as far west, nor apparently as far south, as it had under its first three kings. Truthfully, Samprati's best efforts could not save his kingdom from collapse. The Puranas identify five Mauryan kings in the last 40 years of their rule, including Samprati. And the three between Samprati and Brihadratha, the last Mauryan, are hardly documented at all. For that matter, even Brihadratha is mostly known for his eventual deposition. That said, the end of Mauryan rule in 185 BCE takes us far past the current history of Persian narrative in 223. At that point, Samprati was still new to the throne and just beginning to reclaim lost territory. So in the next regular episode, we will return to the narrative, where we last saw the Seleucid Empire apparently on the verge of collapse. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conqueror's Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.